Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. For this series of podcasts, I have Samuel Ireland, and Sam likes to hide, I feel like, because this man knows his stuff, and he's with the Foam Frat team, which includes Tyler Costafoli, Cynthia Griffin, and a whole bunch of other people. But Sam, I feel like, is that guy in the background who makes wonderful posts and has great information, but I felt like I had to lure him out with a little bit of candy or something for him to come and talk tonight. Maybe beer. Maybe I need to get you some beer at Wimsa. Is that the fix there, Sam?
That is the fix, yeah. You visited us up at Wimsa, so I think you pretty much got the gist of how we operate up here. But yeah, I was telling Chip before the podcast started, I didn't even really have a Facebook before we started Tyler and I started the Foam Frat Facebook. So I am not the social media guru that that Tyler is at all.
But you do know your stuff, Sam. So first off, before we dive too deep into our topics here, can you give us a quick introduction to yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Sam Ireland. I'm a critical care paramedic. I'm up here in Wisconsin, and Tyler and I do the Foam Frat podcast and blog, and then we also do the Prolific Project.
Yeah, actually, go ahead and plug in the Prolific Project here real quick, because I think it's something really cool you guys are working on right now.
The shameless plug you want me to put in right here?
Yes, shameless plug right up front. Let's do it.
Okay, here we go. So yeah, we just released this kind of like a separate entity called Prolific. And what we're doing, we just are right about in the middle of running our first course right now. And it's called the Speaker's Atlas. And we're helping people with like slide design and presentations and doing some personal coaching. And then what we're doing as well is we're like helping them to avoid like those, you know, when you go to a conference and people have like those terrible speaker habits and you can't listen to their talk because of they're doing, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And so we're like helping people become self-aware and to not do that so that they can get good speaker reviews and keep helping out with FOMED and, you know, different types of like formal education and stuff too.
So you're telling me that I should have actually registered for your course?
There is room in the next one. No, I'm just kidding. You did a great job at WEMSA.
Well, at least good enough I got an invite back, which I appreciate. I'm looking forward to November. So thank you guys very much for that.
Yeah, I'll be seeing you there. I'll be there in November as well. Obviously, it's in my backyard.
Yeah, yeah. And at the Dells. So shameless plug on WEMSA. They didn't even have to pay us for anything.
No, we will invoice them after this, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So make sure I at least get a cut on this. But you came on today. And like I said, we're going to kind of break this up into two parts because I think they're very much connected, but different enough that it's worth talking about this as two separate conversations. And what we're talking about here is about ventilatory failure, the difference between impending and acute ventilatory failure. And so Sam is, very knowledgeable in this. And so we had a couple of different discussions, and I really wanted to have Sam on the podcast just to have him in general because he's so knowledgeable. But then when we got talking about this, like, man, I really would love to go off of this a little bit more. He's, I believe, made some great posts on this on Foam Frat. And so now we're just going to get him in audio form to talk about it. So first off, let's go with impending ventilatory failure. Can you talk about that, Sam?
Yeah. So the ones we're going to split up, like you said, is the impending ventilatory failure and then the acute ventilatory failure. And I feel like when you first hear about these, you would initially think that the impending ventilatory failure is worse, because sometimes we think about like respiratory distress and then respiratory failure and then like impending respiratory arrest. And so that word impending kind of carries a different connotation when we talk about ventilatory failure. So actually the impending is not as bad as the acute, and so we're going to kind of start with the one that's not as bad first, and then probably how we split this like part two or something like that will be the worst one, which is the acute ventilatory failure. So impending ventilatory failure is that patient that can somewhat maintain normal blood gases. And I say somewhat. So the thing about them is you can tell it's not going to last too long. So these are patients that like gradually build up CO2 and it's climbing instead of coming down. And when you look at them, they look like they're end-tidal CO2 maybe should be coming down, but it's not. So these patients, if you look at them from like a purely like here's the cold hard numbers that are, you know, never really too hard, they should have a respiratory rate of at least about over 30. If you took a blood gas on them, whether an ABG or a VBG, you'd probably see a PCO2 or an end-tidal CO2 at least above 50. But here's the kicker. They're going to have a misleadingly high minute volume. So usually their minute volume is over like 10 liters a minute, which if you think about somebody, like let's say you just intubated somebody, you put them on the ventilator and they got like a CO2 problem. They got like this ventilation problem and they have a minute volume of 10 liters a minute. Well, you think like, actually that, you know, that sounds pretty good. They should be eliminating CO2. But that's not the case with these people because their respiratory rate is so high, but they have a low tidal volume. And so when we think about, like, let's say, like, go back to that intubated patient, you know, usually we got like 6 to 8, you know, that's pretty average cc's per kilo of ideal body weight, you know, based on their height. These people are usually moving much less than that, like 3 to 5 cc's per kilogram. And we know that if we did that to an intubated patient, they would definitely start to build up CO2. And that's exactly what these people are doing. So they don't like have the strength to move like big tidal volumes. And so they just try to compensate with rate and they just like keep plugging away at the rate and the minute volume looks real good, but they're never overcoming their dead space enough times per minute to actually get rid of that that CO2. And so I always think about these patients, and this is actually pretty fitting because up here in Wisconsin, we just got dumped on by a bunch of snow. And so I think about these patients as like stuck in a ditch. They're stuck in the ditch of like impending ventilatory failure, and they're spinning their wheels really, really fast. Like that respiratory rate is kind of spinning real, real fast, but they're not moving anywhere because they're kind of stuck in that ditch. So that dead space, that stuff that's actually going to eliminate that CO2, it's not really going anywhere. And so that's the impending ventilatory failure. They're breathing fast, but they're not moving enough to get rid of that CO2.
Okay, so since we mentioned dead space so much here, just for the people who may be listening to this, because we do have a fair number of students and we have people across the spectrum as far as experience and knowledge base, can you talk a little bit more about what specifically you mean by dead space, like what it is?
Yeah, dead space is an anatomical amount of air. And that air is everything that is inside of the non-conducting airways. So basically everywhere, you know, like we always think about the alveoli, like all the gas exchange takes place inside of the alveoli. The CO2 comes out, the oxygen goes in, but before the air reaches those alveoli, it's not participating in any gas exchange. For instance, like you think about like the large bronchioles, think about the trachea, think about the larynx, think about the tongue, like all the nose, all that stuff. No gas exchange is going on in those places. So when you move air in and out, it has to overcome everywhere from right outside the alveoli all the way until it, you know, leaves the mouth or nose to the atmospheric air. And so that volume can be measured. When we put people on ventilators, if they're like an average size adult, some people will average it out and say, oh, it's like 120 milliliters if they're intubated. You can also use 1 cc or 1 milliliter per pound of ideal body weight. So you'd figure out their height, what their ideal body weight is, and then one cc per pound of that ideal body weight would be like an estimate of what that volume actually is. And there are pulmonary function tests that can actually just about tell you what that dead space is.
And it's worth noting here just real quick too, that with dead space, it's going to increase with our ventilatory equipment, right? So when we intubate a patient and then we got to talk about the actual tubing between the vent and the actual patient getting all the way down, like you said, to the alveoli, that it adds additional space. So usually we kind of double that number as kind of just the general form as well, correct?
Yeah. And I think about that, like, I think the easiest way to illustrate that is like, imagine a snorkel. And why a snorkel can't be super long. Like when you put that snorkel on your mouth, if that snorkel was like a super, super long ways, you wouldn't be able to effectively eliminate all the CO2 out of the end. and or get enough like room or I mean oxygen in to breathe. And so you'd end up like slowly suffocating because of this long snorkel, because your lung volumes can't overcome that long snorkel. And so that's why they're not like, you know, 20 feet long, is because you just end up rebreathing all of your CO2. And so if you can think about that illustration about how a long snorkel wouldn't work, well, now just imagine that, you know, the snorkel is basically your trachea, but you're moving really small amounts of tidal volume, and it's basically the same thing. You're going to rebreathe that CO2.
And see, right there is why I say Sam and other people like him, but I love listening to these guys, because you just explained such a complex concept, something that we take for granted a lot of times, people who have been doing this for a while and stuff. And I love the way you just simplified that and using the snorkel illustration. It provides a great image. So I appreciate that. That's why I love talking to you guys, because you're able to explain this and just simplify it in such an easy to understand way. So let's talk about now management for these patients.
Yeah, so management for these impending ventilatory failure patients, it's a lot about their tidal volume. So the first thing you have to do is correct their tidal volume, but we can never forget the underlying pathology too, because just moving more air in and out of the lungs and like overcoming that dead space and just providing that with more tidal volume, because I mean, yeah, giving them more tidal volume is obviously how you're going to get rid of that CO2. But we have to remember before, you know, because we're going to talk a lot about like the mechanics of giving them tidal volume, we shouldn't forget that they ended up in this situation because some kind of pathology is going on down in the lungs. You know, they're having an allergic reaction, they have COPD, they have, you know, whatever the case might be, they're tired because of, you know, cardiogenic shock, something like that, something else is going on. And so we can't forget the underlying condition. But when we talk specifically about fixing this CO2 problem, the answer is going to be tidal volume. And so then we think about, well, how do we make more tidal volume for these patients? And so there's a right way and there's a wrong way to titrate the BiPAP. And I know people say, well, BiPAP is a, you know, trade name. Any kind of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation that you're doing that has two levels is what we're talking about. So this will do when we talk about managing the different pressures to give them more tidal volume is we're buying time for whatever inhaled or IV interventions that we have going to start working. So this is kind of a bridge to definitive treatment. So how you fix these people generally depends on what you're trying to fix first. We'll mostly talk about CO2, and then we can touch on the oxygenation in a minute as well too. So like I said, it's a tidal volume issue when you're talking about CO2. And what you have to do is, using your BiPAP, your bi-level positive airway pressures, is you have to create this thing called a delta, or some people will call it a delta P. And what that means, like RTs are real familiar with this kind of language, but for us, we kind of learn as we go. But a delta or a delta P is the difference between two pressures. So like usually everybody on BiPAP, you know, we start them off at like 10 over 5, right? And so the difference between those two pressures is 5. And so if I put somebody on like 15 over 5, so I move the top number up, but I leave the bottom number the same, well, that's a delta of 10. Or, you know, continuing with that, if I put somebody on 20 over 5, that would be a delta of 15. And so if you didn't titrate that delta, it'd look like, you know, it'd be like 10 over 5, and then you go to 15 over 10, and then you go to 20 over 15. And if you titrate them without ever increasing the delta or the delta P, you're not going to ever move more tidal volume. So let's say they're not doing well on 10 over 5. This patient who needs more tidal volume probably will not do any better on 15 over 10. And they probably won't even do any better on 20 over 15, because the delta is still 5. And that's where you get your increased tidal volume from, is from going from a low pressure to a high pressure.
All right, perfect. So let's recap this real quick as well. So with impending ventilatory failure, you're talking about someone who's in respiratory distress with a high minute volume, but with a low tidal volume. And so although they're breathing a lot and it looks like they're exchanging a lot of air, the problem is that we have too much dead space where we're not able to clear that CO2 out. So how are we going to do that? Well, we need to affect essentially with our BiPAP, and like you said, it's technically a trade name, but it's easier to keep track of it that way, our BiPAP, and we need to do the delta pressure. So we need to be able to provide them with more tidal volume. And so this is not, like Sam just said a second ago, 10 and 5, 15 and 10, 20 and 15, so on and so forth. We need to look at, okay, we try 5 and 10. That didn't work. 12 and 5, and then 15 and 5, or whatever it takes to get those patients. But we have to remember that we're trying to increase the tidal volume here, and that keeping the same pressure every time we go up is not going to fix the ultimate underlying issue.
Yeah, and a good way to track this, it really depends like what kind of BiPAP machine you have. I know in EMS, generally when we're putting somebody on BiPAP, we don't have like specific BiPAP machines. And so we're usually using full function ventilators as our BiPAP. So they just have like non-invasive modes. And so we get numbers like the tidal volume exhaled, we get an active minute volume, we get like a spontaneous frequency. And we, if you're lucky, like the ventilator that I use, the Envy, you get waveforms on there. So you get the flow volume loops and things like that, or like Hamilton T1 has those as well. And so if you have these numbers, you should probably have a goal in mind for these patients. So like if they are breathing, like, let's say they're on the real like bad side of like low tidal volume. So they're at like, you know, 3-4 cc's per kilogram of ideal body weight, and those are the tidal volume exhaled that you're getting. You want to pick a number that's, you know, isn't going to retain CO2. So especially if it's like, let's say a COPD patient or something, you might want to aim like 7-8 cc's per kilogram of ideal body weight or higher, you know, as long as they're not air trapping and their peak pressures allow it. So what you can do is just figure out what their ideal body weight should be, and then multiply that by whatever cc's per kilogram you want. And then you can increase your pressure until you start getting those, tidal volume exhaled. And that should be like a good, that would be like a good parameter to see like, okay, I've increased the pressure enough. But obviously if you're working with, that comes with caveats. If you're working with a COPD patient who's known to air trap or something, you obviously want to make sure that you're not giving them so much volume that they can't get rid of it.
And how are you going to watch for that, Sam?
So for us, we watch on flow volume loops, and we also, you can just physically watch their chest as well. And we also watch peak pressures. So if their flow volume loop, like they're still exhaling quite a bit and quite forcefully, and then the next breath starts, they probably did not exhale all of that tidal volume. And over time too, what will happen is the peak pressures will continue to escalate because the pressure inside their chest is just continuing to go up.
Before we end this part of our discussion, can we talk a little bit about the FiO2 side of this? So obviously we've talked about PEEP and how we're managing that with our EPAP and IPAP, but what about for these high hypoxemic patients, the FiO2 portion?
Yeah, so usually when we're having an FiO2 problem, because, I mean, sometimes these COPD patients, they will come in, you know, hypoxic, but usually they respond to oxygen pretty quickly unless they have like an underlying pneumonia or their bronchitis is so bad that they have so much mucus in there that's causing like a ventilation perfusion mismatch or like pulmonary shunt. So in those instances, you may need a higher baseline pressure if you're dealing with somebody that, so this would be somebody maybe who doesn't need as much tidal volume, maybe they're breathing a little bit larger of a tidal volume, but you just can't seem to get their SpO2 up. And so initially off the bat with all these patients, because you're adding pressure to the lungs, you can probably use 100% FiO2 right off of the bat until you get them stabilized because you're using PEEP along with it. So a lot of times we worry about when we put somebody on 100% oxygen that they'll get this thing called absorptive atelectasis. And what that is when we give them 100% oxygen, the body will readily absorb that oxygen. So if you can picture like oxygen holding tension inside of an alveoli, if the body absorbs all the oxygen that's inside that alveoli, the alveoli might collapse. And it's hard to get an alveoli open at times. And so you have to have pressure behind that oxygen in order to maintain that pressure so it doesn't collapse. Because then you kind of fixed, you know, one problem, you fix the hypoxemia maybe, But then you now have like more of a VQ mismatch because now you're dealing with atelectasis. So you want to use a higher baseline pressure with those patients. So when we talked about those patients that we titrated up kind of in tandem with the same delta, so, you know, 10 over 5, 15 over 10, 20 over 15, the patients who are simply hypoxemic and they have like pneumonia or they have pulmonary edema, they will probably respond better to low deltas and higher baseline pressures than somebody who needs tidal volume.
I think we're going to wrap that portion up right here, if that's okay, unless there are any other comments you want to make first.
No, I don't think so. I think that pretty much covers the impending ventilatory failure and then a little bit at the end there about the strictly hypoxemic patient.
Real quick, before we go, and we'll be back next week with the second portion, can you give us the tagline?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.